sleep this time holding my hand, Eric's diamond ring cutting into my palm like the wounds of passion from the crucifixion. I would do that for her, I realize. Die. Be reborn.
Delia. When we were kids, Fitz was unbeatable at Scrabble. It would drive Eric crazy because he wasn't used to being bested by Fitz in much of anything. But Fitz had an uncanny memory, and once he saw a word, he wouldn't forget it. There is no such word as Lynn, Eric would argue. But sure enough, Webster's defined it as a waterfall. Personally, I thought it was sort of amazing that anyone 12 years old would know that a pyx is a container for the host during communion. But Eric wasn't used to being second best, so he commissioned me into teaching him the dictionary. We worked our way through the letters with the same incredible focus that Eric applied to anything when he was inclined. I'd make up vocabulary tests for Eric and quiz him when he ate dinner over at our house. At the very least, my father used to say, you two are going to ace your SATs. 3 weeks after we'd taken on the English language, it rained on a Saturday. Hey, Fitz suggested like usual, bet I can whip you in Scrabble. Eric looked at me. Huh, he said. What makes you think that? The 570,000 other times I've kicked your ass? Fitz knew. The moment Eric laid down the letters J-A-R-L and then casually mentioned that it was a term for a Scandinavian noble, Fitz's eyes lit up. Our board was full of words like larum and gurn and got and rivet. Finally, when the score was almost tied, Eric set out valgus. Fitz started to laugh. I don't think so. Triumphant, Eric passed him the dictionary. He waited until Fitz found the right page. Turned abnormally outward. Twisted. Fitz shook his head. You got me. But you still lose. And he set the word fungible on a triple word score, pulling into the lead. What does it mean? I asked. It's us, Fitz said. Look it up. I did. I liked the word. It sounded like something you could punch into position, like a soft pillow, or hold on the roof of your mouth. I expected it to mean inseparable, brilliant, loyal. Any of 100 adjectives I could apply to us as a trio. Fungible, I read. Interchangeable. In the morning, while Sophie is still fast asleep, I shower in Fitz's motel bathroom. He comes in as I am brushing my hair. Without saying a word, he takes the comb out of my hand and tilts my head back. He works through the knots first and then makes long, sweeping strokes from the crown of my head to the ends. Our eyes meet in the mirror, but neither of us speaks. We are afraid that whatever words we pick won't be able to bear the weight of what's happened. Do you want me to come with you? He asks. I shake my head, still attached by a rope of a loose ponytail to his fist. I need you to take care of Sophie. I have told him I need to talk to Eric. I just haven't told him I'm stopping somewhere else first. As I drive, I relive what it was like to sleep in Fitz's arms last night. As much as I would like to credit this, too, to a memory lapse, I know it isn't. I can't blame Eric's drinking, either. What I did was a mistake. Because I am engaged to Eric. But what if that was the mistake? I met Fitz and Eric at the same time. We have all been friends for years. But what if the way I remember my relationships evolving with the two of them is different from the way it actually was? What if the things I've chosen to recall got twisted somehow during the recreation? What if last night wasn't wrong, but finally, remarkably right? I swear to you, my mother says urgently, Victor never would have done any of that. We are sitting on her patio under a mister meant to counteract the blistering heat. As the water sprays out of the tiny nozzle heads, it immediately evaporates. It makes me think of those first years of my life, the ones that disappeared before I ever had a chance to really see them. You know what? I say wearily. I really don't know who I'm supposed to believe anymore. How about yourself? She shakes her head. Did you ever think that maybe the reason you can't remember any of that is because it never happened? I know I'm the last person you'd turn to for credibility, Delia, but your father, he wasn't here. You used to follow Victor around in the backyard, helping him plant his gardens. You followed him like a puppy. You wouldn't have done that if he'd been hurting you, would you? She sighs. Maybe your father thought he saw something even though he didn't. Maybe you said something one day that didn't make sense to him. But maybe he was just jealous because there was another man spending time with you, and he was afraid you'd found a replacement. I realize suddenly that everyone is a liar. Memories are like a still life painted by 10 different student artists. Some will be blue-based, others red. Some will be as stark as Picasso and others as rich as Rembrandt. Some will be foreshortened and others distant. Recollections are in the eye of the beholder. No two held up side by side will ever quite match. In that moment, I want to be with Sophie. I want to take off our shoes and run through the red sand. I want to hang upside down from the monkey bars with her. I want to listen to the jokes she makes without punchlines. I want to feel her sidle closer to me when we come to a street crossing. I want to make new memories instead of search for old ones. I have to go home, I say abruptly. My mother gets to her feet, but I say I will let myself out. She hesitates, unsure, and then leans forward to kiss me goodbye on the cheek. We don't quite connect. I head through the side gate and walk along the crushed stone path toward my car. I have just unlocked the door when a truck drives up. Victor steps out, and we stare at each other, palpably uncomfortable. Delia, he says. I didn't do what he said. I look at him, then open my car door. Wait. He pulls off his baseball cap and holds it in front of him. I never would have hurt you, he says earnestly. Elise couldn't have children. I knew that. And it was a blessing that she already had one I could share. I know you can't remember, but I can. He is looking right at me with his solemn, dark eyes. His mouth trembles with his conviction. I try to imagine following him around as he plants, dropping small white stones in mounds around the cacti. I begin to hear in my mind the names of some of the flora and fauna in Spanish. El Pito, El Mapacha, El Cardo, La Garra del Diablo, Woodpecker, Raccoon, Thistle, Devil's Claw. You were like my daughter, Gria, he says, uneasy in the silence. And I loved you like a father. Nothing more. Gria. I am watching him plant the lemon tree. I've gotten tired of dancing around it. I want to make lemonade already. How long will it take? I ask him. A while, he answers. I sit down in front of it to watch. I'll wait. He comes over and takes my hand. Come on, Gria, he says. If we're going to sit here that long, we'd better get something to eat. He swings me up onto his shoulders. He clasps the backs of my legs to steady me. His hands are butterflies on the insides of my thighs. With trembling fingers, I fumble for the latch of the car door.
Delia? Victor asks. Are you all right?
That word, Gria, I say, my voice coming out a faint whistle. What does it mean?
Gria? Victor repeats. Cricket. It's a, how do you say, term of endearment.
From a distance, I feel myself nod. It's not a surprise to find Eric asleep. It's only 9 in the morning. I find him on the bed inside the trailer, with the empty bottle beside him. He is naked, wrapped partly in a sheet. I reach down and pull it off him. He scrambles upright, wincing when the light falls into his bloodshot eyes.
Jesus Christ, he murmurs. What are you doing?
For a moment, it is 3 years ago, and this is one of the 100 times that I came into a room to find Eric after a night of drinking. Back then, I would have put on a pot of coffee and dragged him into the shower. 3 years ago, I had a whole host of techniques for immediate sobriety, and yet none of them ever got him to react as quickly as the method I employ today. Eric, I announce, I remember.
Part 10. From Terry Tempest Williams, as quoted in Listen to Their Voices, Chapter 10, by Mickey Perlman, 1993. Memory is the only way home. Eric. Memory has had a spotty record in the United States court system. For a while, recovered memory was all the rage. Adults went to therapists who planted seeds for trauma that didn't really exist. Hundreds of people came out of the woodwork to accuse childcare workers of abuse and Satanism, and their recollections were allowed as evidence and treated as fact. In the mid-90s, however, the tide began to turn. Judges steered clear of recovered memories, saying they weren't valid unless they were supported by independent evidence. We happen to be 28 years late for that. Still, it's new evidence, and I'll be damned if I'm not getting it in. Delia has given me a list of the memories, the ones that are coming fast and furious now that the wire has seemingly been tripped. The lemon tree in its entirety. A pair of boxers Victor used to own with blue fish printed all over them. Having him sit on the edge of her bed and lift her nightgown to rub her back. Victor asking her to pull down her underwear and touch herself. I have to treat it the way I would any other evidence. If I think too hard about it, I want to kill someone. I send Emma flowers at the birthing center of the hospital. The card reads, Delia has started to remember the abuse. Consider this notice of my intention to bring these memories into the trial. 2 days later, she moves for a 702 hearing to address the scientific reliability of the evidence. We're in the courtroom, but it's a closed hearing. Just the judge and the attorneys, no media or jury. Emma wears a maternity dress, but it's pouchy and bunched at the stomach. Allison Rebbard, Emma's expert witness, is a memory expert affiliated with a string of Ivy League universities. She has a thin face accented by pink wire-rimmed glasses, and she's used to sitting in a witness box. Dr. Rebbard, Emma asks, how does memory work? The brain can't remember everything, she says. It just doesn't have the storage capacity. We forget most of what occurs, including events that were probably significant at the time. Now, the things that do stick, well, they aren't like images on a videotape. Only minimal bits of information are recorded, and when we recall it, our mind automatically fleshes out the recollection by inventing details based on previous similar experiences. Memory is a reconstruction. It's contaminated by mood and circumstance and 100 other factors. So a memory might change over time? It most likely will. But interestingly, it seems to retain its mutations. Distortions become part of the memory in subsequent recalls. Are some memories true then, while some are false? Emma asks. Yes, and some are a mixture of books we've read or movies we've seen. One of my studies, for example, focused on children at a school that was attacked by a sniper. Even the kids who weren't on school grounds at the time had a recollection of being there during the attack, a false memory that was probably inspired by the stories they heard from their friends and on the news. Dr. Rebert, Emma asks, is there a general agreement about when a child is capable of retaining traumatic memories? Overall, we say that events that happen before age 2 won't be remembered past childhood, and memories before the age of 3 are rare and unreliable. Most researchers believe that serious abuse after the age of 4 will be remembered into adulthood. Delia Hopkins has not been seeing a therapist, but has been experiencing recovered memories, Emma explains. Would that surprise you? Not given what you've told me about this case, Dr. Rebert says. The preparation for this trial and the testimony itself would force her to relive hypothetical scenarios. She's wondering why her father might have taken her. She's wondering if there was something in her past that might have precipitated it. It's impossible to tell whether she's actually remembering these things or if she only wants to remember them. Either way would explain a period of her life she doesn't understand and would most likely vindicate her father's behavior. I'd like to address the particular memories that Ms. Hopkins claims to have recovered, Emma says, and I jump up. Objection, I say. This hearing is only about admissibility, Your Honor. It would be premature to have the state's expert judge the reliability of memories without hearing the actual testimony of the memories and how the witness experienced them. Or, in other words, you have to let my evidence in first. Judge Noble looks at me over his half glasses. Is Miss Hopkins here to testify? No, because she's barely speaking to me. Not today, Your Honor, I say aloud. Well, that's your problem, son. We're going to allow your offer of proof to stand as to what she might testify to in open court, and I'm going to allow Ms. Wasserstein to proceed. Emma approaches the witness stand. In the first alleged memory, she says, Ms. Hopkins remembers Mr. Vasquez wearing boxer shorts printed with blue fish. In the second alleged memory, Mr. Vasquez is coming into her bedroom at night and stroking her back. In the third, he asks her to remove her underpants and touch herself. Is this damning evidence, in your opinion? Often we'll see a subject come to a therapist with a few disconnected traumatic images, sort of like bits of a black and white photo. These are what we'd call deteriorated memories. Isn't it possible, Doctor, that Miss Hopkins remembers seeing Mr. Vasquez in his boxers because, like every other child on the planet, she walked in on him in the bathroom? Absolutely. And what if the reason he was in her room at night was not to harm her, but to comfort her after a nightmare? Very plausible as well, Rebert agrees. And as for the third, What if there was a medical reason for the request? For example, if the child had a yeast infection and Mr. Vasquez wanted her to apply cream to the area. In that scenario, Dr. Rebert points out, he's going out of his way to not touch her. The point here is that we don't have the whole memory, the whole story. Unfortunately, neither does Miss Hopkins. She's looking at a striped tail and screaming because it must be a tiger, when in actuality it might be a house cat. I don't have an expert witness. I couldn't have afforded one even if I'd had the foresight to find one. Instead, I've spent the past 2 days poring over psychiatric texts and legal briefs, trying to find what I can to trap the state's expert during cross-examination. I approach Dr. Rebert with my hands in my trouser pockets. Why would Delia want to make up a memory that's so painful? Because the fringe benefit outweighs that, the psychiatrist explains. It becomes a hook for the jury to hang its hat on and acquit her father. Repression is defined as the selective forgetting of materials that cause pain. Isn't that true? I ask. Yes. It's not a voluntary act. No. Can you explain dissociation, doctor? She nods. When a person is in a state of terror or pain, perceptions get altered. Attention is focused on the present moment and surviving. When attention becomes that narrow, there can be great perceptual distortion, including desensitization from pain, time slowing down, and amnesia. Some psychiatrists believe that removing the anxiety can lead to remembering what happened, she adds. But I'm not one of them. Even though you don't believe it, however, dissociative amnesia is a valid psychiatric condition, isn't it? Yes. In fact, the DSM-4, the Bible of psychiatric diagnosis, even lists it. I lean down to the defense table and read aloud. Dissociative amnesia is characterized by an inability to recall important personal information, usually of a traumatic or stressful nature, that is too extensive to be explained by ordinary forgetfulness. That seems to describe Delia Hopkins, doesn't it? Yes. I continue reading. It commonly presents as a retrospectively reported gap in recall for aspects of the individual's life history. Again, that's a bullseye. Apparently. In recent years, there has been an increase in reported cases of dissociative amnesia that involves previously forgotten early childhood traumas. Bingo. I look up at her. This manual only lists diagnoses that have come from years of empirical data and clinical observation, right? Yes. And it's considered a conservative document? Yes. You use this manual professionally, don't you? Yes, but as an analytic tool, not a legal one. She tilts her head. Do you know when the DSM-4 was written, Mr. Talcott? I freeze and scan the front of the book. 1993? Right. Before the rise of repressed memory therapy led to hundreds of false convictions of sexual abuse. Ouch. How does a triggered memory differ from a recovered memory, doctor? There's a school of thought that says memories of traumatic moments are just as abnormal as the moments themselves and don't have the same associations that other memories do, which means they're harder to bring front and center in the mind. But by the same reasoning, trauma-specific clues might be able to trip those memories. So a triggered memory isn't planted, so to speak. It really does exist and has just been waiting for the right time to break free. That's right. Can you give an example? A subject might hear a gun go off in close proximity, and then suddenly remember a gunshot years ago that killed his father when he was standing next to him. Isn't it true that this scenario is closer to the way Delia Hopkins has recovered her memories, Doctor? The psychiatrist nods. And isn't it possible, Doctor, that there is a place memory can go until it's ready to come forward again for whatever reason? That recovering a memory might not be a recreation, but a search and rescue mission. The words remind me, of course, of Delia. I suppose so, Mr. Talcott. I take a deep breath. Nothing further. Emma stands up again. By the defense's own reasoning, if Ms. Hopkins was recovering memories of traumatic childhood events when there was a trigger, such as courtroom testimony, wouldn't it make sense that she'd react the same way to similar triggers? Theoretically, Dr. Rebert agrees. Then why didn't she have a barrage of recollections about her abduction? Emma poses, as I object. Nothing further. I'm already approaching Dr. Rebert again. What if it wasn't traumatic? I ask. I'm not sure I understand. What if, to Delia, the kidnapping wasn't something frightening? What if she considered it a relief, a way out from the sexual abuse? In that case, Dr. Rebert, a memory of the abduction wouldn't have been triggered by her father's testimony, right? This time, Dr. Rebert gives me a full smile. I suppose not, counselor, she says. Emma is showing me pictures of her son when the judge comes back with his ruling. The issue here is whether we can forget events that took place, Judge Noble says, and if we can remember events that never took place. This topic, of course, is a highly charged one. No matter how I rule, and no matter what we say to the jury, we're going to be dealing with a situation where the jurors are going to have a hard time separating their feelings from the events being discussed. He looks at Emma. The greatest tragedy of this trial would be to believe another lie from Andrew Hopkins. And as it stands, the evidence is not reliable enough to justify inclusion. Then he turns to me. I'm making a legal decision here, but I can't make the emotional ones. I'm damn sure my decision isn't going to make you very happy, son. But I want you to remember that even though I can rule out what happens from this point forward, I can't take back what's already been said. Maybe in New Hampshire, those judges don't tell it like it is, but here in Arizona, we do. And I want you to know, Mr. Talcott, you may think your case hinges on this evidence, but I expect you're going to do just fine without it. He gets up and exits, Emma behind him. I sit for a few moments in the empty courtroom. If this were like old times, I would go home and tell Delia that I'd lost the hearing. I'd repeat verbatim what the judge had said, and I'd ask her to interpret it. We'd dissect my performance until she finally threw up her hands and said we were going nowhere with any of this. She will not be back tonight, I suppose. And we're still going nowhere.
Andrew. Delia is the last person to enter the courtroom before the doors are shut. She is wearing a yellow dress, and her dark hair is pulled back off her neck. It reminds me of a long, lovely sunflower. I have so much to say to her, but it is better done afterward anyway, when I will likely have yet another reason to tell her I'm sorry. Beside me, Eric gets to his feet to address the jury. "You know what love is, ladies and gentlemen?" he asks. "It's not doing whatever the person you care for expects of you. It's doing what they don't expect. It's going above and beyond what you've been asked. That's what Andrew Hopkins should be charged with, you know. That's what he would plead guilty to, hands down." The prosecutor is going to talk to you about obeying rules. She's going to use words like kidnapping. But there was no kidnapping here. There was no force. And as for rules, well, you know there are always exceptions. What you might not know, however, is that the same thing applies to the letter of the law. Eric walks toward the jury. The judge is going to tell you that if you find that Andrew had committed all the elements of kidnapping beyond a reasonable doubt, then you should convict him. Not that you have to, not that you'd like to, but that you should find him guilty. Why doesn't the judge say that you must find him guilty? Because he can't. You, as jurors, have the ultimate authority and power to convict or not to convict. No matter what. Objection, Emma Wasserstein steams. Bench. The two lawyers approach the judge. Your Honor, he's telling the jury they can nullify the whole charge if they want to, the prosecutor complains. I know, Judge Noble says evenly. And there's nothing I can do about it. When Eric turns around, he's stunned. I don't think he expected to get away with this. He swallows and faces the jury again. The law is very deliberate, and it chooses its words carefully. And sometimes, on purpose, it opens the door for that gap between rule and reason. You have a choice to make, ladies and gentlemen. Some choices are not made lightly. Not the ones Andrew made, not the ones the law makes, and I hope, not your own. Emma Wasserstein is so angry, I expect to see sparks flying from her shoes. Mr. Talcott has apparently been spending too much time with his client, she tells the jury. Because he's just lied to you. He told you this isn't kidnapping, because there was no force involved. Well, nobody asked Bethany Matthews if she wanted to go. Maybe he didn't tie her up with duct tape and throw her in the back of his van for the ride to New Hampshire. But he didn't have to. He told a poor, innocent child her mother was dead. He told her that she had nobody but him. He did so much damage to this child in an effort to wrestle her out of her mother's home that he might as well have bound and gagged her. This was emotional duct tape, and Andrew Hopkins was a master. She turns to look at me. But he didn't just affect the life of one victim. This rash, selfish act claimed two. Bethany Matthews and her mother, Elise, who spent 28 years waiting to see the child who'd vanished. This rash, selfish act gave Andrew Hopkins everything. The child, full custody and freedom from punishment. Until now. Emma moves toward the jury box. For you to find Andrew Hopkins guilty of kidnapping, you must agree that he took a child without having the authority to do so, and that he did this with force. Andrew Hopkins himself even said on the stand that he had indeed kidnapped his daughter. You can't get much clearer than that. Yet, as Mr. Talcott said, rules don't always fit. Mr. Talcott pointed out that the law says you should convict if all these conditions are met, but that you don't have to. Well, let me tell you why that's not quite as simple as he's making it out to be. She walks over to Eric. If we lived in a world where rules were trumped by emotions, then we'd be in a very uncomfortable place indeed. For example, I could do this. Without hesitation, Emma picks up Eric's briefcase and moves it to her own table. Because I like it better than mine. And if I could convince you from an emotional standpoint that I have good reason to like it better than mine, then hey, you would be justified in saying I was allowed to steal that briefcase. She walks back toward Eric and picks up his glass of water, drinks it down. If we lived in Mr. Talcott's world, I could come over here and drink his water, because I'm a nursing mother and I deserve it. But you know what? That kind of world would also be the place where rapists could do what they wanted, because it was what they felt like at the time. She approaches the jury again. It would be the kind of world where if someone was overcome with rage, it would be okay to commit murder. And it would be the kind of world where if someone could convince you it was really just an act of heroism, he could steal your child away from you for 28 years. She hesitates. I don't live in that world, ladies and gentlemen. And I bet neither do you. While the jury is deliberating, Eric and I hole up in a tiny conference room. He orders corned beef sandwiches from a kosher deli and we chew in silence. Thank you, I say after a moment. He shrugs. I was hungry too. I meant for representing me. Eric shakes his head. Don't thank me. I take another bite. Swallow. I'm counting on you to take care of her. He looks down at his hands, then sets down his sandwich. Andrew, Eric replies. I think it might have to be the other way around. We are called back for a verdict in less than 3 hours. As the jury shuffles in, I try to read their faces, but they are inscrutable, and none of them meet my eye. Is that a sign of pity or of guilt? Will the defendant please rise? I do not think I've ever been as aware of my age as I am in that moment. It is nearly impossible for me to stand. I find myself leaning against Eric, even when I try to remain straight and brave. When I cannot bear it any longer, I turn my head and look for Delia in the gallery. I hold on to her face, a focal point while the rest of the world is going to pieces around me. Have you reached a verdict? The judge asks. A woman with tight red pin curls nods.
We have, Your Honor.
What say you?
In the case of the State of Arizona versus Andrew Hopkins, we find the defendant not guilty. I am aware of Eric crowing with delight, of Chris Hamilton slapping us both on the back.
I try to find enough air to breathe. And then Delia is there, with her arms around me and her face pressed into my chest.
I hold tight and I think of something Eric said just after his closing statement.
It's not a real defense, he murmured. But sometimes that's all you've got. Sometimes it even works. There is a commotion as the reporters vie for Eric's soundbite. Gradually, the crowd falls back to allow Emma Wasserstein passage. She shakes Eric's hand and Chris's, and then leans forward to give Eric's briefcase back to him. But as she does, she comes close enough to whisper to me. Mr. Hopkins, she says, a truth meant only for me. I would have done it too.
Fitz. I am trying to find a back exit that we might use to escape when Delia appears and throws herself into my arms. I'm still not used to that. Immediately, every conscious thought or rational plan flies out of my head while I just enjoy the feel of her. Congratulations, I say into her hair. I want to tell Sophie, she announces. I want to tell her, and then I want to drive straight to the airport and get on the first plane to New Hampshire. And what happens then? Delia, so happy about the verdict, hasn't even touched down close enough to ground to remember all that's been left behind. It's nice to know that the atomic bomb missed your house, but you will be cleaning up the rubble for some time before your front path is clear. As it turns out, I don't want to write the story of her life. I want a series. Stop thinking, Delia says. The same advice I once gave to her. She sweeps forward and, jubilant, kisses me, which is just when Eric turns the corner. She can't see him. I'm the one facing the opposite end of the hall, but she breaks away from me when she hears his voice. Oh, he says quietly. It's like that. He looks at me and then at Delia. I was trying to find you, he murmurs. He shakes his head and turns around. Stay here, I tell Delia, and I hurry after Eric. Wait up! He stops walking, but he doesn't turn around. Can I talk to you? Eric hesitates, but then he slides down the wall to sit on the floor. I sit down beside him. In spite of my facility with language, I can't think of a single word to say to make this better. Let me guess, Eric says. You never meant for it to happen. Hell yes, I did. I've wanted her since you two started dating. Surprised, Eric blinks at me, and then even laughs a little. I know. You did? For God's sake, you're about as subtle as Hiroshima, Fitz, he sighs. At least I didn't lose the girl and the case. I look down at the floor. Incidentally, I never meant for it to happen. I should beat the crap out of you. You can try. Yeah, Eric says quietly. I just might do that. Then he glances up at me. If I can't take care of her myself, there's no one else I'd want to take my place. He hesitates, and when he speaks a moment later, his voice is heavy with hope. I'm going to clean up, he vows, this time for good. I want you to, I tell him. I'd like that. Eric will be with us. Maybe not as often. Maybe not even in the same neighborhood. Maybe not for a while. But we are three. None of us would have it any other way. He smiles, his hair falling over his brow. Be careful what you wish for, Eric says. I've learned my fair share about abduction. We sit for a few moments, although there's really nothing left to say. This is new to me, too. An entire conversation that takes place in silence, because the heart has its own language. I will remember what Eric says, even though he doesn't say a word. I will tell it to her.
Delia. There is one other person who hangs back in the courtroom, unwilling to face the storm of media that is waiting on the other side of the doors. My mother waits at the end of the aisle, her hands clasped in front of her. Delia, she says, I'm happy for you. I stand a foot away from her, wondering what I am supposed to say. I guess you'll be going back home then. She smiles a little. I hope we can stay in touch. Maybe you'll come back for a visit. You're always welcome to stay with us. Us. At the mention of Victor, something shut down inside of me. Eric says that we can try to press charges against Victor if the statute of limitations hasn't run out yet, that this would be a whole new trial. As much as I want him to pay, there is a part of me that wants to just put it behind me. But even more, I want my mother to believe me. I want her for once to take my side instead of her own. He hurt me, I said baldly. I did remember. But you don't, so it couldn't have happened, right? She shakes her head. That's not true, I finish, the word bitter on my tongue before I swallow it. I wanted you to be my mother. I wanted one so badly. I am your mother. I think of what would happen if someone, anyone, touched Sophie. It wouldn't matter who it was, Victor, the man in the moon, Eric. I'd kill him. An icicle through the heart, a car filled with carbon monoxide. He would not take another breath if he touched my daughter. I'd find a way to hurt him that didn't show, just like he'd done to her. And if Sophie was the one who came to tell me about it, I'd listen. In this way, I am different from my mother, and for that, I'm incredibly grateful. When I look up at her, I don't feel regret or sadness or even pain inside. I just feel numb. I wish I could tell you that I know you did the best you could, I say softly. But I can't. As a child, what I was missing was so much bigger to me than what I had. My mother, mythic, imaginary, was a deity and a superhero and a comfort all at once. If only I'd had her, surely she would have been the answer to every problem. If only I'd had her, she would have been the cure for everything that ever had gone wrong in my life. It has taken me 28 years to be able to admit that I'm glad I did not know my mother until now. Not because, as my father suspected, she would ruin my life, but because this way I did not have to bear witness as she ruined hers. My mother's sorrow is so powerful. It cracks the clay tile beneath her feet. It makes the water in the fountain behind us overflow. Delia, she says, as her eyes fill with tears. I'm trying. Me too. I reach for her hand. A compromise. A goodbye. Maybe this is as good as it gets. Eric and I sit in the anteroom of the Madison Street jail while we wait for my father's paperwork to be completed. I'm careful to keep an inch of space between us. Even when we are cramped tight by others, it shifts with us and keeps me from brushing up against him. Once that happens, I will not be able to keep myself from falling apart. We watch a parade of felons, prostitutes who try to come onto the detention officers, gang members bleeding from open wounds, drunks who sleep in the corners and sometimes cry in their sleep. You know, he says after a few minutes, I might just stay here for a while. In jail? In Arizona. It's not so bad, really. And I've got at least one judge who likes me. He shrugs. Chris Hamilton offered me a job. Really? Yeah, right after he chewed me out for not telling him I'm an alcoholic. I stare down at my hands. That's not why I did it, you know. That's exactly why you did it, he corrects. And that's why I love you. He reaches into his pocket and pulls out a piece of paper with an address scrawled across it. This is the closest AA meeting. I'm going there tonight. My eyes fill again. I love you too, I say. But I can't carry your baggage. I know, Dee. I'm not sure what I want right now. I know that too, Eric says. I wipe my eyes. What am I supposed to tell Sophie? That I said this was the best thing for her mother. He takes my hand and traces his thumb across my knuckles. For God's sake, if I learned anything during this damn trial, it's that the only way someone can leave you is if you let them. And I'm not doing that, Dee. It may look like that today or tomorrow or even a month from now, but one day you're going to wake up and see that this whole time you've been gone, you've only been headed back to where you started. And I'll be there, waiting. He leans forward and kisses me once, feather light on the lips. It's not like I'm not letting you go, he murmurs. I'm just trusting you enough to come back. When he stands, he is tall enough to block the line of the sun. He is all I see for a moment when he walks out the door. We leave the jail and head onto the highway. But instead of going back to Fitz and Sophie, I pull off at the first exit and veer to the side of the road in a cloud of dust. For the first time, I allow myself to look at my father, really look at him, since this trial has begun. The bruises on his face are healing, but his nose is never going to be straight again. His hair is still tufted and spotty from the shave. He sits with his arms crossed tight as if he doesn't quite know what to do with all the space in the front seat. And even when the grit gets unbearable, he will not roll up his window. You probably have some questions for me, he says. I look away over the flat of the desert. There are wild boar out there and coyote and snakes. There are 1,000 dangers. You can trip on a garden hose and wind up in a coma. You can eat a bad mushroom and die. Safety is never absolute, no matter what precautions you take. You should have told me about Victor. He is quiet for a full minute, and then he rubs his hand over his jaw. I would have, he says, but I honestly didn't know whether it was true. My mouth drops open and I cannot move, cannot breathe. What? I didn't have any proof. Just a feeling. I couldn't risk leaving you there with him, but I also couldn't take a hunch to the cops. What about what you saw through the window? He shakes his head. I don't know if I really did see that, Delia, or if I just convinced myself I did over the years. The more time that passed, the more I wondered if I'd jumped to the wrong conclusions. And I needed to think I hadn't, because that way I could justify running away with you. He closes his eyes. It turns out that if you want something to be true badly enough, you can rewrite it that way in your head. You can even start to believe it. You lied on the witness stand, I manage. It just came out. And when it did, even when I realized that it could be the thing that saved me, I felt awful. But then I thought, maybe you'd forgive me, he says. I'd spent almost 30 years being someone I wasn't for you. So maybe you wouldn't mind spending a week being someone you weren't for me. I do not tell my father about the memories I've had of Victor. Memories that were never heard in that courtroom. Memories that would validate his intuition from so long ago. I don't think about what I know and what I've painted over in my mind. There isn't one truth. There are dozens. The challenge is getting everyone to agree on one version. So I ask the only question, really, that's left. Then why did you take me? My father looks at me. Because, he says simply, you asked. I am sitting in the front seat of the car with my toes up on the dashboard. I close my eyes so the ribbon road in front of us vanishes, and I pretend it would be this easy to disappear. Please, Daddy, I say, don't take me home yet. When I open my eyes, it has started to rain. Fingers drum on the roof, and I roll up the windows of the car. What if it turns out that a life isn't defined by who you belong to or where you came from, by what you wished for or whom you've lost, but instead by the moments you spend getting from each of these places to the next? I glance at my father and ask him the question he asked me exactly a lifetime ago. Where would you go if you could go anywhere? His smile lights me. I drive east, toward Sophie, toward home. I follow a procession of telephone poles that stand with their arms outstretched, marching toward the horizon line. They keep going, you know, even when you can't see where they're headed.
The End. You've been listening to Vanishing Acts, by Jody Pico. Narrated by Julia Gibson as the voice of Delia, Jonathan Davis as Eric, James Jenner as Andrew, Robert Ramirez as Fitz, and Sharon Washington as Elise. This book was directed by Julie Bakoyan. If you've enjoyed this book and these performances, Recorded Books recommends About Grace by Anthony Doerr, narrated by Henry Strozier. David Winkler dreams things before they happen. A man carrying a hatbox will be hit by a bus. He will fall in love with a woman in the supermarket. Both come true. But when Winkler dreams that their daughter, Grace, will drown while he's trying to save her from a flood, to keep this from happening, he flees, moving to a Caribbean island and remaining there for 25 years. Not until he dreams again of saving an island girl from drowning does he embark on a journey to find his lost wife and daughter. We also recommend Any Place I Hang My Hat by Susan Isaacs, narrated by Carol Monda. Amy Lincoln is a 20-something political reporter with a sad and troubled past. After encountering the illegitimate son of a presidential candidate, she is inspired to begin a search for her own mother, who abandoned her as a child. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another recorded book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call the toll-free number found on the back of this book. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse our catalog, place orders, hear about our latest releases, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.